You are listening to a sermon by Ken Hockley, recorded on Sunday, June 2, 2013, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
When I looked at the texts for today, this one is one that is very familiar. Is it new to anybody? Has everybody who has heard this story before, read this story before? All right. I was going to get you to raise two hands. Then we could be Pentecostal. But it's a very familiar story, and it's one that is dearly loved by many. In this time of Elijah, Israel, before the current king Abraham, Israel was going through kings like corn through a goose. But finally, Ahab took the throne and ruled for 22 years. Now, Ahab and his infamous wife, Jezebel, were worshippers of Baal. And in the New Testament, the indication is that, that name is pronounced Baal, but Baal is a whole lot easier to pronounce. So that's the way I'm going to do it. Baal was considered a fertility god, a god of the sky, a god of rain, of storms, and by some, the king of all gods, a position that he took through treachery and through winning the position from another god. Abraham and Jezebel had erected temples and altars all over as soon as he took power, and they began killing off prophets of other gods, including the god Yahweh. And so some of the prophets were killed, and no doubt Ahab and Jezebel were repressive monarchs. There wouldn't be anything like human rights back then, but if there were, they would have not taken any account of any human rights and would have been very repressive, very dominant, and people would have suffered. They would have paid high taxes, high prices to line the coffers of Ahab and Jezebel. God had warned Elijah to hide from Ahab, and we learn later that Obadiah, a fellow prophet of Elijah, hid 100 prophets, again, at Yahweh's instruction. So this constant lament that Elijah calls out that he's the only one left is really not true. There are a great many prophets still left, but Elijah felt like he was the only one. And I'll get to that in just a moment. The treachery and the infighting and everything that Ahab and Jezebel were responsible for, of course, are infamous. And because of that and the worship of God Baal, we're told that there was a drought that came onto the land. While Elijah was in hiding, Yahweh probably figured that Elijah would get the blame anyway, so he should hide from Abraham. And for 3 years, there was a drought. After 3 years, the drought ended, but the king was still not impressed with Elijah, and Elijah was sent back to the king to confront him. The king accused Elijah of causing trouble, and Elijah returned the favor and the accusation, and then set up this contest that we had read to us. So the whole thing reads like one of those improbable movies where the hero faces mind-boggling odds and nonetheless comes out on top. 450 prophets to one. Now, the core of this saga, this story, is the sacrifice. This sacrifice, though, is something different from the other instances of ritual sacrifice practiced as, for instance, as a kind of seal on a covenant such as we have in Genesis 15:17, where Abraham, at the end of a covenant with God, is asked to seal that covenant by taking animals and splitting them in two. And then this mysterious torch and flame passes between and among the carnage that Abraham has been asked to present. It's a seal of the covenant that was made between God and between Abraham. This particular contest, if you will, is also different from the many substitutionary sacrifices used for generations among the Hebrews to alleviate sins. The sacrifices that are listed in the book of Leviticus and Numbers, almost ad infinitum, it would seem, the grain offering and the sin offering, and it goes on and on and on, the burnt offering, the whole burnt offering. There are offerings for every category and kind of animal and plant that you can think of. But this is different. This was staged kind of as a revival. Elijah was hoping that through this challenge to the prophets of Baal, that the outcome would help the people make up their mind. He says at the beginning, how can you limp along with two opinions? Get off the dime. You're either worshiping Baal or you're worshiping Yahweh. And so through this challenge, Elijah hoped that the people would then realize that the true God was Yahweh. So it was a revival of sorts that Elijah was hoping for. Obviously, the tribes of Israel were not the only ones who practiced sacrifice. The prophets of Baal were very familiar with it. In fact, there are indications that even much earlier than that, the Egyptians staged sacrificial rituals for millennia before Christ was born. And the Babylonians had sacrificial services at least 3,000 years before Christ was born. Some people in the ancient Near East worlds not only sacrificed animals. There's evidence that children, women, and royalty on the losing side of a war were also sacrificed in various rituals. The Hebrew worship could have been influenced by some of these habits from surrounding regions, or perhaps they were the ones who influenced their neighbors. We're not really sure. But it seems that sacrifice is one thing common to many peoples that has to do with relating to their God. One note of interest here regarding the story is the choice of animal for sacrifice. Elijah apparently knew enough about Baal worship to know that one of the myths about the god Baal was that he had sired a divine bull calf. The details of that are rather off-putting, so we won't go into details. But the bull was a very important part of Baal worship. So what better animal to use and, in the end, to add another layer of mockery onto the contest. It seems like Elijah's choice of sacrificial beast was a masterstroke on a number of levels. The other thing of interest is the use of fire. And in the reading, I'm always caught by when the fire comes down, Elijah calls the fire down, it consumes everything. It says it, you know, it consumes the wood, it consumes the bull, it even consumes the stone, and it even licks up the water. I just see this fire as a living thing. There is a little bit of anthropomorphization with the fire that is not there. It seems as though the prophets of Baal are waiting for a fire from their God. And there is a bit of a hint there that the fire that comes from Yahweh is actually living. And you wonder, could it have actually been meant to be God, Yahweh, coming down as a living entity in the fire? But fire is a sign of power and might for both Yahweh and Baal. In fact, fire from heaven has played in other biblical texts. I mentioned the Genesis 15 text. Leviticus 9 involves 9:24 involves fire from Yahweh that consumed Aaron's sacrifice, his first sacrifice, as again a seal of a covenant, but also as a sign of approval. The fire came down and consumed the sacrifice. And there are others throughout the Pentateuch and even in Judges, Chronicles, and Kings. And interesting, in Job 1:16, where Job gets the bad news about his sheep from one of the shepherds who comes and says that Job's sheep and shepherds were consumed by, quote, the fire of God, which, quote, fell from heaven. And consumed everything except for this one shepherd who got away. One wonders what he was doing. But to tell Job about the bad news. And so in this case, the fire from heaven could be seen as a judgment from God. But still, both the fire in this case and the sacrifices from the Elijah story have some common themes here. One of the themes is it has to do with the relationship, with forming or cementing or strengthening the relationship with Yahweh, with God. All of the other kinds of sacrifices that we know about for the, you know, the sin offering, etc., also had to do with relationship with God, making the relationship right again after the people had gone wrong. Even in the Elijah story, we can say that it was Elijah's attempt to get the people back into relationship with Yahweh by showing the power and the might of God over this other god that they thought was pretty hot stuff. No pun intended. Elijah was concerned about the relationship that the people would have with Yahweh. The other thing that is prominent here, I think, is one of the first things that need to be apparent when the sacrifice was being done. In all the sacrificial rituals, the first thing that we assume and is most important is a willing heart. Elijah was willing to put his reputation and Yahweh's reputation on the line. Yahweh had a heart that was Elijah had a heart that was connected to Yahweh. And that's the first thing that's needed. Elijah was willing to trust in God, willing to risk everything, willing to risk his own status as a prophet of Yahweh for a greater purpose. He was willing to fight against imposing odds, willing to believe in a greater good. Today, when we think of sacrifice, we don't think of animal sacrifice. Paul helped us in that by changing how we think about sacrifice. He claimed that Jesus and his sacrifice was a game changer in many ways. One of the things that it did was change sacrifice from a ritual that is performed by someone else to something personal that we give up. And Paul gives us models like Romans 12:1, where he asks us to be a living sacrifice. And Ephesians 5:2, to live a life of love just as Christ loved us and gave himself up. These are things which now bring the idea of sacrifice into our own personal space and into our communities of faith. Now, some may be uncomfortable with the idea of sacrifice. Are we called to sacrifice? Is it necessary to sacrifice as individuals and as a community of faith? And if we are called to sacrifice, do we have the first thing that's needed? Do we have a heart connected to God? Peter Sung is a student from the seminary. He came to us a number of years ago. Did I mention Peter last time? Yes, I did. I mentioned Peter last time. Who remembers about Peter Sung? All right. That's why you let me speak a second time. Peter is from South Korea. And he came to the seminary with a vision from God. And his vision was that he would be trained at the seminary and then would go back to South Korea, collect materials, and move into China. He would go north into China and smuggle himself into North Korea to start Christian fellowships in rural districts. And then, when whatever network he could set up, when he was warned that things were getting a little too hot and the government authorities were getting a little too close to finding out what he was doing, who he was, and where he was, he would smuggle himself back into China, move to another region, and start all over again. He came to the seminary for training, biblical studies, and all the things that we do best. He also came for discernment. He was willing to make this sacrifice. Danger to his own life. He had a young family. His wife was also willing to let him do this if it was God's will, if it's what God wanted. So he came to the seminary for discernment, for 3 years of discernment. I believe, I don't know, because I've lost touch with Peter, I believe that he is currently back in Seoul, South Korea. I'm not sure if he's in North Korea yet. But he was still, when he left, he was still willing to go. And what you got when you talked to Peter was that he had the first thing that he needed. His heart was connected to God. He was willing to put his life on the line. He was willing to risk everything for a greater purpose. He was willing to do whatever it took in order to be faithful to his relationship to God. Now, like Elijah, we might feel called to put ourselves on the line. And some of us are willing to risk much. Some of us are willing to risk less. There are the Peter Sungs in the world, and there are those who post on Facebook that they will give up chocolate for Lent. Perhaps we are called to pattern our sacrifices after that of Elijah's, in that we are to put ourselves out there, to stick our necks out. One of our favorite storytellers in the States is Garrison Keillor, and he talks about the Lutheran Church. And he says, when you go into a town and look for a Lutheran church, you look for the plainest building in town. It often just looks like God's potato barn. It's not fancy at all. And he says, the one thing that's distinctive about Lutheran churches is that they don't have steeples. The idea of Lutherans sticking their neck out is foreign to them. And I wonder if that's not the same in that regard with us as Mennonites. The notion of sticking our neck out just really doesn't feel right. It's not part of who we are. We're the quiet in the land, the still im Lande. We would rather do something good and then have people ask us, wow, what makes you do that? Rather than go out and proclaim that we are doing this for the Lord. It's interesting. I was talking with someone in the States from the Federal Emergency Management Association, or FEMA, and they said that they appreciate Mennonites during disaster when the Mennonites come. As a matter of fact, they said they thought that they think FEMA actually stands for Find Every Mennonite Available. We are known for our works, but are we known for sticking our neck out? There are the old saws of causes that we have around us all the time that we can step forward and defend. We can stick our neck out for. We have poverty, we have broken homes, prejudice, child pornography, war that we sometimes or often get involved in. But there have been issues that we may be willing to risk for. Elijah, before he risked, he had the first thing. He had a heart connected to God, but he also knew about the dangers. He knew about the Baal worshippers. He knew the danger of Ahab and Jezebel. He knew the dangers and stepped forward anyway in confidence because of his heart connected to God. Sometimes an individual can help a community. Probably no one here has heard of Arne Sehr, S-E-H-R. He was a Dane who lived during the Second World War. When war broke out, the Danish declared their neutrality and reduced the number of their army. Arne Sehr happened to be one of the social and political leaders at the time, and he wrote a manifesto of sorts on what it meant to be a good Dane. It included nonviolent resistance to any invading army. In the ensuing years, after Germany invaded Denmark, the Danish people consistently refused to cooperate with the Nazis. At one point, not complying to a direct order to identify and deliver up all Jews so that they could be deported. The defiance of the Danes against the Nazi regime is inspirational. It was also costly for the Danes. Many Danish resistors went to prison, were killed, were tortured. Failing is one of the biggest roadblocks that we might have when we think about sticking our neck out, about making a personal sacrifice, about standing up for something. But failing is one of the biggest preludes to success in life, in business, and in faith. Sticking our neck out, taking risks, making real sacrifices can not only affect change, it can pull us together as a community and strengthen us as individuals. The important thing is that we have the first thing we need, a heart connected to God. A heart that believes enough to risk, to gamble, to be vulnerable for a greater cause, even against Elijah-sized odds, even against a Nazi army. But having the first thing does not guarantee success or fame. The story of the Danes is not a well-known story. Arne Sehr is not a household word. Many, many Danes were killed. And yet, they did what they believed was right. For this congregation, for you, I don't know what the issues could be that you might want to stick your neck out for. You each may have a purpose that really burns in your heart, or you may be like me, knowing that there are many things, many good things to give time for, to give effort for, but really not doing much of anything. And coming up with all sorts of excuses. There may be among you people who have a single cause, who have stuck your neck out, who have made a stand, who could be an inspiration to the rest of us. But having that one thing in each of us, having that first thing, a heart connected to God, is what we need to work on most of all. Dorothy Day's famous quote applies here. Never doubt the power of a small group of committed people to bring about change. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has.